there, everybody. It is Wednesday, February 15th, 2012, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm Ken. As always, you can drop us a line, get in touch with us by emailing us at ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn about all the fun things happening with our little dog and pony radio show. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We are welcoming one of our favorite guest back to the show. Hey, mystery guest, are you ready to go?
I am so ready.
We are pleased to welcome, for the third time, Mariah Hansen, the founder of Club Skirts, which is celebrating the international cultural phenomenon of the Dyna, taking place this year, March 28th through April 1st, 2012. This event is hallmarked, as always, by the hottest lineup of celebrities and entertainers, lavish locations at deluxe hotels, and participants totaling 10,000 plus. Everybody has to go to the Dyna. Mariah Hansen, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Hi, Ken. How are you?
How the heck are you doing?
Oh, I am so excited about this year, Ken. I'm just enjoying the Dyna work more than ever.
Wow. Because what are we in year 22? Is that where we are?
We're in year 22.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. It's crazy. But we're in the most exciting year ever. One of the things I'm really looking forward to is we're really becoming a very established music festival.
Oh, yeah.
And as such, the talent this year, even though most people aren't going to recognize these names yet, I have phenomenal talent this year. Everyone I've booked is not only an emerging artist, but they have incredible stage shows.
Wow.
And then I have Chaka Khan.
Chaka Khan. Oh, my gosh.
Chaka Khan. So I'm excited, and we are bringing the production to a whole new level this year.
We have to back up a step, just for folks sure. that for some reason don't even know. Tell people, give us the core spiel of the Dyna.
Well, the Dyna is the largest lesbian event reputedly in the world. And for 5 days, lesbians kind of converge on the town of Palm Springs, California, and they take over the Riviera Resort, the Hilton Hotel, and then lots of blocks in most of the hotels in town. And we party for 5 days.
It's a fun time, you're saying.
It is one of the most exciting 5 days, I think, for lesbians all year long. It's bikinis, it's bands, it's comedy shows, it's thousands of women from all over the world hanging out together and just celebrating the fact that it's lesbian pride in Palm Springs.
And I ask you this every year, and I love hearing your answer evolve, and so I'm going to ask you yet again for the third time. Mariah, what do you think that the Dyna contributes to the gay community?
Certainly, I think a sense of real celebration for lesbians and an empowering 5 days where we just celebrate our femaleness. There's a certain quality of estrogen, really, that's just raging for 5 days in the most marvelous way, and I love that. Although, as we grow, we are getting more and more men, because I think that the LGBT community is changing. I think that guys and gals like to party together again, and I love that. I think younger gays and lesbians are really embracing a more unified front.
Nice.
And so that's reflected too, but there's still, honey, there's so much estrogen, it's just insane. But it's great, because it's that kind of women power, and it's really empowering for the guests that are there. I also think that, you know, lesbians are not known for being super trendy.
Okay.
And I think that's a stereotype, but it's one that's still prevalent. But I think that with the onset of shows like The L Word and so much more LGBT visibility in the media, we are kind of obtaining our own kind of visibility through music, because lesbians are really becoming a power force in helping emerging artists to take off. The Dyna Shore Weekend really stands for a really important concert venue for a lot of the emerging acts to get a lot of worldwide recognition because of the viral strength of the Dyna and people talking about it and the net. And so we're considered trendsetters now and in the music industry, and I love that. I think that's so cool.
I love that. So what does February look like for you? So, you know, it's we still have a ways to go until March, but it's not that far away. Is this, what is the craziest time? I would imagine the craziest time is March 28th through April 1st.
Absolutely.
So what does February look like for you?
Well, Well, February is a lot of planning.
Yeah.
And because of, like, really great things like Skype, you know, I have meetings once a week with my senior staff, and we're really just on it this year in terms of just making sure that this year people are going to be wowed. No one is going to recognize the parties that we do this year. We're stepping it up to a whole different level. We definitely don't have any significant competition this year. And so I was confronted with two choices. Well, when you don't have competition, you can do one of two things, or maybe even three. You can do the same thing.
Right.
You can do less because you don't have to do more, or you can do more just because that's your standard.
That's your standard.
And we chose to do more because that's our standard. And so I thought, you know, this is the year for us to really step it up in a way we never have before. So the production level is going to really wow the women. They're going to walk into the two main parties and their jaws are going to drop at what we're doing with the production. It's going to be so visually stimulating.
Now, we don't often get to talk about the business side of you, because you are indeed, I would argue, a businesswoman, would you not say?
Yeah, I think you could describe me like that.
So as a businesswoman who's putting on a pretty darn large-scale event, what do you look for in staff? What kind of folks do you surround yourself with to get the Dyna happening?
Well, you need to surround yourself with people that are very good at what they do.
Yeah.
At an event at this size, I'm kind of I lead my team in a sense, but I also, you have to have a team that is an expert at what they do. So I have the best sound and light company. I have the best general manager. I have the best publicist. I work with people that are really good at what they do, and then I let them do it. I'm not a micromanager. So I look for people that are self-sufficient in their work, you know, they're just their work ideology, that they really can get up and go and make things happen. And but you got to surround yourself with good people. So I think that's pretty much paramount. But I also make sure that my staff's positive, because I think that the mood of an event starts at the top. And so when people walk into my event, from me to my senior management to the rest of my team, we come in with an attitude of, we are very happy and honored that you've chosen our event to come to.
Nice.
We don't take the attitude of, you're lucky to be here, wait in line. We're too cool. It's just not, it's that kind of nightclub or event attitude has never sat with me. And so my staff has to embrace that mission statement that we're servicing people. We're making sure they have the best vacation that they've ever had. And that means that we treat them with a freaking big grin the minute they get there.
Yeah.
And that we are available for them to make sure that they're having the time of their life all weekend long. And I think we're pretty successful at that. I'm really happy about my staff's commitment to that really positive, empowering attitude.
And how do you think your staff would describe you? And please know that I will call them after this interview to confirm that that is indeed the case.
I'm afraid now. I don't know. I mean, I think my staff would... my feeling about my staff is that they have the level of commitment to producing this event that I do. And so I think they would agree that this weekend means so much more to me than business. And I hope that I infect that feeling into their own work ethic, because I get that it's oftentimes a vacation. It's where women have met and fallen in love. It's where people have met their best friends. I hear stories about women who meet once a year at the Dyna because they've been doing that for the last 10 years. They met 10 years ago, and they all became buddies, but they live all over the country or the world, so they meet there.
Yeah.
And I mean, things like that are really powerful. They make me realize that what I do is so much bigger than a party.
Yeah. Well, I would say there are two, I mean, I'm sure there are many different categories of people who go to the Dyna, but there are two categories that we can place every single person who goes there into. People who have gone before and people whose first time it is going to the Dyna.
We call that Dyna Ho and Dyna Virgin.
Nice. So for the Dyna Virgins, oh boy, is there an orientation for them? Because I would imagine that it could be a little bit overwhelming.
There's not really an orientation now.
So what would you tell? All right, so I am...
I would come for all 5 days if you're new, because there's a warm-up party on Wednesday. It's a meet and greet for the early birds.
With stretching and everything. That's great.
Yes, exactly. And weights. Well, it's just a really great opportunity to meet people without the throngs and crowds. So I would recommend that. But I do think that any event can be clicky. I think Medina is less so, partially because we try to create an atmosphere where it's not. So I think it's actually easy to kind of, with the right attitude, to come meet new friends.
There you go.
Like I tell people who say, I'm coming by myself. Is that going to be okay? It's like, absolutely. If you're going to come with yourself and read a book by the pool for 5 days, you're probably not going to have the same experience if you came by yourself and kind of smiled and went, hey, I'm so-and-so. Who are you?
So what would you say to, so I'm going to the Dyna. It's my first time going. I get there. Holy cow. I didn't know there were going to be thousands and thousands of lesbians. I'm feeling so overwhelmed. What do I do?
Please do not forget that your body is made of 90% water.
Okay.
And that you might want to try to maintain that, that equilibrium. I tell people to pace themselves.
Okay.
There's so much to do and
yeah.
there's a lot of fun times. But I would not recommend someone come find me.
I'm coming to find you if I get overwhelmed. I'm just saying.
I definitely don't want that. But you can come talk to my staff up front. They're actually, they all know that they're available for people to go, oh, my God, you know, what do I do? Where do I start? My staff's really great about going, oh, hey, yeah, no, just go there, get that. This
awesome.
Is what you need.
Good. Well, in the past, you've had social justice elements to the Dyna. I know a few years ago you had the no hate pictures going on poolside. Any elements this year?
I have that every year. I think it's really important.
Oh, good.
That you party with a purpose, even if it's a very subtle. I don't think you spoon feed anyone politics at an event like this. That's just not what they're there for. But I do think that an event of this stature has to have some political component to it because you've got too many people in the same place not to introduce some ideology that they might take with them when they leave. So this year we're really concentrating on a human rights campaign and on the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center.
Oh, one of my favorites.
So, Human Rights Campaign is going to be throwing a cocktail reception, I do believe Friday night, right before the big party. And we're going to be releasing more information about that in the next few weeks. And then I always have the Gay and Lesbian Center in Los Angeles, which is run by Lori Jean, because they're a prototype for most of the centers in the States. And so I feel like when I support them, I'm supporting every community center.
Oh, she is one of my favorites.
Don't you love her?
I love her.
She's always part of my event in some way or another.
Love
and
it.
I think it's really important that as people are parting, they also remember that it's so easy to forget that we are still in a really serious battle for
civil
rights.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Yeah.
But I think it's so easy for younger LGBT people in any country, well, certainly in the States. I don't know about any country, but certainly in the States, in a lot of pockets in the United States, it's more easy than ever to be LGBT. And since it's easier and more people are acceptive of our lifestyle, it's kind of easy to forget that, hey, we still can't get married in most states. And, you know, there's still a lot of laws that don't protect us but protect our heterosexual counterparts. And so I think it's always kind of important to remind everyone, but especially younger people, that we still have a little work to do.
We have a lot of work to do. Partying with a purpose.
Partying with a purpose.
Partying with a purpose.
Always.
Well, we do have to talk, as always, about your musical selections for this week's episode. We have time for a couple of these songs. So this, and you know this well, this is the part of the show, Mariah, where you tell our listening audience what a couple of your song selections say about Mariah Hansen. Now, I will also pull back the curtain, because I already figured this out, that you chose some songs of artists who are actually going to be at the Dyna, but this does not get you off the hook, Mariah, to do some self-analysis on what these songs say about you. Nice try, though. So let's start with Cece Peniston, who will be at the Dyna. Her song, I'm Not Over You. What does that
mean? You want to get really personal?
Let's go for it.
That song is for this woman that I've been in love with for 10 years, and I still can't get over her.
Does she know?
She probably does.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. I don't even know which one to do next. I kind of want to do Winter Gordon's By My Love, because that goes in a whole different direction for you, Mariah Hansen.
Well, that's just how I'm feeling now that I'm bitter.
They go hand in hand.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. I think Winter Gordon is going to be one of the more formidable artists in the next couple of years. And I just love this song because he's just really hip and whimsical and playing around with themes that, you know, she's basically talking about, you know, how you kind of can buy me things. And it's just really tongue-in-cheek and it's cute, but I think her musical talent is just formidable. So she's someone that I love listening to. I'm really excited that I booked.
Well, the question on everyone's mind that you get asked every year, what is the role for me, Ken, at this year's Dinah?
Ken, I have a very special role for you.
Because I want to come. I want to come, but I need to have a purpose. I need to party with a purpose.
I have a party with a purpose for you.
Tell me.
Okay, I want you in drag.
Okay, what else do you have for me?
No, listen, and I want you in the lesbian dodgeball contest.
You really just put me in drag and people are throwing balls at me? That's the purpose you have for me?
What's wrong with that, Ken?
That's just like a Tuesday night for me. That's
exactly.
Nothing special.
No, it's because the Celestians are so bad at dodgeball, okay? And they need a little help. They get creamed every year by our attendees. And if you watch any of the videos on YouTube, you just see these Celestians get taken down. They need you, Ken.
Let's review for the folks at home on what I just heard. What I just heard was putting me in drag is going to make people throw the ball harder. Is that what I just heard?
No. I think you're just going to be so talented at dodgeball, you're going to help the lesbians.
Is there a karaoke night somewhere I can host? Okay, we should probably talk off the air because I would like a range of options.
All right, you got it.
So where can folks go to learn more about all the cool things happening with the Dinah? Are the hotels sold out? Where are we right now?
The Riviera is definitely sold out. The Hilton is probably about halfway sold out. And they're actually doing a $20 off offer. If you book at the Hilton, you get to take $20 off any of the passes, which is a great deal. But I've got hotels all over town. So you go to thedinah.com. And you can look at the event page to see our lineup and the hotel page to see what's still available. And we just redid our site. It's pretty amazing. So just go there to tell me how you think I did redoing it.
Nice. We will do that. So now let's do your pitch. You got two pitches. One to the Dinah Virgins. What do you have to say to the Dinah Virgins to get them to sign up and go?
Dinah Virgins, really, it's time to just let it go and really take that whole experience to a new level. Let that virginity go.
There you go.
You need to go to the Dinah. And to the hoes?
Yes.
Save a little bit for the virgins.
Okay.
Okay.
Take one under your wing.
Take one under your wing. It's such a phenomenal weekend. I do think that based on our sales and the fact that we're selling out of hotels so quickly, I think this is going to be the largest Dinah Shore weekend in history.
Unbelievable.
It's definitely a not to miss.
And we would also advise everybody who's going that should you see an awkward-looking drag queen, maybe ease up on throwing the ball at her. Maybe ease up a little bit.
Exactly.
I'm just saying. That's really more of a social justice message that I wanted to put out there.
Part of the purpose.
Oh, Mariah, you're one of my favorites. You are one of my favorite guests. I would love, you know I would love to get out there one year, right?
Why don't you? Come on.
I know.
I want you out, and I think that you would really, really have a blast, Ken, and you would, next year when we talk, you'll have a completely different perspective. You owe it to your listeners to get out to the Dinah.
Well, oh, gosh, when you put it like that, I don't know that I can turn that down. Is there a Dinah Virgin t-shirt I can get?
I'll get you a Dinah Virgin t-shirt, and I will also protect you.
Oh, okay. I didn't even know. Well, there's balls flying at my head. I'm not even touching that.
Protect you. Yeah. Well, I kind of put it out there, and I think you're gonna have a blast, honey.
Oh, I can't wait to call your staff. Anyway, Mariah.
Are you really calling my staff?
No, not a chance. I trust that they'll say good things, Mariah. It is, as always, just an absolute treat having you on the show. Here is wishing you the best time at the Dinah. I know you know this, but you really do put together just one of the most incredible events. I know it's an event that people look forward to every year, and it's an event that's so life-changing, not just for people finding their partners, but for celebrating, for being who they are, if even for those few days. It is so important to the LGBT community, and I thank you on behalf of the community for putting this event on.
Thank you.
All right. Mariah Hansen, as always, a treat. All the best with the Dinah.
Thanks, Ken.
Okay, bye, Mariah.
Bye.
All right, folks, and we are back here welcoming to the show. Zach, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Let me introduce you. Zach Mordechai is an actor, a comedian, a singer. One of our listeners wrote in and said, why haven't you had Zach Mordechai on This Show Is So Gay Yet? So we wrote to Zach Mordechai and said, why haven't you been on This Show Is So Gay Yet? And here welcoming to This Show Is So Gay. Zach, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you. It's like magic.
Isn't it crazy how the whole internet works?
I still don't understand it. It's amazing.
If there's an actor, comedian, singer out there, we can cyberstalk them and get them on the show. And here you are.
Totally, totally.
So we have to trace your career path to the entertainment world, because I would argue, I don't know if you would agree, that you've had kind of not the most traditional path to where you've ended up.
Well, you know, I'm grew up very Jewish, so I went to medical school. I think that goes without saying.
Of course.
So I first went to yeshiva all my life. I was studying to become a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi. All my life, since I was 2.5 in playgroup, I was in a class of all basically Orthodox white men.
Nice.
Up until Yeshiva University, where I started coming out in Yeshiva University, and they were terrified. They didn't know what to do with me. So basically, one of the deans took me into a room and said, you know, you're causing too much of a ruckus on campus. What do you think about getting into medical school early?
Ooh.
And at that time, I was pre-med, and I was like, all right, let's do it. Woohoo! So I was kind of a little Doogie Howser. I went to Stony Brook Medical School kind of early, and the last 2 years of college basically in medical school. But then when I actually started working on the hospitals, I didn't like it at all. I mean, nothing against sick people, but it just didn't, you know.
It wasn't your gig.
Wasn't my gig.
Okay.
I just figured everybody else was going into hospitals to leave hospitals, and I was coming because I wanted to. I didn't want to. So I just left. And my parents were obviously really disappointed. I mean, they couldn't say my son the doctor. But I had to follow my dream.
And so then how did you make that work? How did you devote yourself to this type of craft?
I just started going on auditions. I was no classes, no anything. I just woke up. I slept on my friend's couch. And I woke up in the morning and just started to go to these cattle calls. And eventually they took on. My first role was actually in Provincetown. I would play the MC in Cabaret.
Look at that.
And that was really, so yeah, it was really fun. I spent about 4 months out in Provincetown, and it was an amazing experience. And then after that, it was just, you know, a steady stream of good jobs. On the side, I was a singing waiter, which was really, really fun.
Where? We always like to know where.
Oh, in Ellen Stardust Diner, right in the middle of Times Square.
Of course. I've been there many a time.
And that was really great because you got to practice your craft.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people. I feel like more people recognize me from Ellen Stardust Diner than any of the shows that I've been in, which is hysterical.
Nice.
But also very gratifying because, you know, any day in Ellen Stardust Diner, you sing in front of maybe, you know, 800, 900 people between, you know, all the people who come in and out. So that was really fun.
And for folks who don't know, that's right on Broadway. I mean, that's right next to Mamma Mia right now.
Yes. Ooh, very good. Very impressed.
Let me tell you, I had the experience, too, of telling my Jewish parents that I was a singing waiter. So what was that experience like for you?
Really?
Oh, yes.
So my parents really never got over the fact that I go to medical school. I feel terrible for them. You know, it's a lot of, I love my parents, they're very, very sweet people, but you know, first you tell them, you know, that my father's an Orthodox rabbi, my mother's an Orthodox woman from Brooklyn, New York.
Nice.
So first you tell them, you know, I'm gay, and then you say, I'm not going to become a doctor. I'm not sure which is worse, but seriously, they were a bit traumatized.
Did they ever come to the Ellen Stardust Diner?
They never came to Ellen Stardust Diner because it's not kosher.
Right, well, there you go.
So, but they've been to some of my performances. They didn't come to Cabaret, but I played Fagin in the national tour of Oliver, and when it came to New York, they came.
Nice.
That was nice.
So what are you working on now? What's got you excited these days?
Ah, what am I working on? Well, first of all, I'm getting ready for the Kesha Cabaret.
Yes.
Really fun.
So that's coming up real soon. That's on March 17th. And for folks who don't know anything about Kesha, which means they haven't been listening to the show, which is a little bit disappointing, tell them about Kesha.
TestEd is a great organization that's based in Boston that works for the full inclusion of LGBT. Do I have to explain what LGBT is?
No, I would hope not to this audience.
So for LGBTQ Jews in the Jewish world. So we want to be included and feel respected and celebrated in our communities. And TestEd is a great organization that works tirelessly for that sort of inclusion and celebration, which is awesome.
Now we can say, because you're on this week's show, that every single person on the bill has been on this show is so gay.
Really?
You complete the Judy Gold, Sir Ari Gold hat trick.
That's amazing.
We needed to be able to, you know, check off our little frequent flyer card there. So, well done.
Well, the truth is that lately I've been doing more entertaining and performing for organizations. I think it's a great little combination to combine what you love to do and what you feel, you know, brings good to the world. I'm, besides the singer, comedian, whatever, performer that I am, I'm also the co-executive director of a group for kids, for LGBT Jews who grew up in the Orthodox world. It's basically a group that focuses on the youth and tries to give them support and advocates on their behalf. It's called JQY, Jewish Queer Youth, and it's a very interesting and challenging thing because you're specifically targeting kids whose parents are probably not very supportive.
Right, right.
And they may themselves be very confused and very scared. A lot of them are in what's known as reparative therapy.
Yeah.
So they're sometimes very traumatized and bullied by their community, which is the worst type of bullying. So JQY is there to make sure that they have a place to go. We have safe spaces. We have we advocate. We do speeches and talkbacks and to their community leaders. And also we're starting to do performances, because it's sometimes the best thing to do with these kids is to empower them enough to express themselves.
Yeah.
And the wonderful thing, without stereotyping, of our LGBT community is that so many of us have performance abilities and have art just seeping out of our pores. And I think I'm excited to say that I think that there will be a huge contribution from these kids, both in terms of performance and in terms of we may be doing an art show. And there's definitely so much of this community is musically gifted. So that's another little pet project that I'm working on, and I'm excited, like I said, to combine my passion for the arts with, I think, some of my ideals to kind of try at least to do the best we can. So.
Do we feel like we're making progress? I mean, you look at the Jewish press, because look, my background is conservative Judaism and mm-hmm. very enmeshed in the New Jersey conservative Judaism world. You know, that was my upbringing. And I look at things like, you know, we've talked about the Jewish standard, but my dad has actually called into the show and complained about the Jewish standard before. But you look at it and tell people who don't know the big developments in the Jewish press in the past couple weeks.
A huge development. First of all, the Jewish press is an Orthodox paper.
Yeah.
It appeals to a pretty right-wing Orthodox crowd and has a pretty large readership also. In the past, the Jewish press has been, I would say, pretty anti-gay.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the articles written in the Jewish press took a very hardcore change therapy or ex-gay point of view, to the point where basically they were supportive or pressuring people to go into change therapy. About 3 weeks ago, a JQI member named Chaim Levin, he wrote an article about his experience in reparative therapy and how much it hurt him, and he was traumatized in an organization called Jonah, which is a reparative therapy organization where he was sent to and then was asked to do terrible, unspeakable things with his counselor, who, by the way, wasn't even licensed.
Jeez.
Things like getting undressed and touching himself, all while this counselor looked on. And this traumatized him to such an extent that he became suicidal.
Yeah.
And finally, he found the community of JQI and really kind of built his self-esteem up step by step and brick by brick to the point where he's strong enough to tell his story to his community. which is great. But what's amazing is that the Jewish press actually published this article.
Right, right.
Now, I will tell you that it didn't just publish this article out of nowhere. JQI members have been kind of talking to the editors of the Jewish press and the writers of the Jewish press, meeting them. It's a small community. We know some of their kids. We know some of their family members. So the idea is, you know, once they started getting to know the LGBTQ people in their families and friends and community, that made the biggest of differences, and they no longer could just kind of shut down our story. So they published Chaim's paper, and there was a huge response. By the way, mostly positive.
Yeah.
There were some homophobic people who got very, very angry and threatened, and in fact even threatened a boycott of the Jewish press. There was some type of organization that tried to reach out to their advertisers and tell the advertisers don't advertise anymore in the Jewish press.
Of course.
And heroically, the Jewish press, in the next week's paper, wrote an op-ed, an editorial, saying that they will not back down to any boycott, to any advertising boycott, or any financial pressure, that they will have the courage of their convictions and will continue telling the stories of our community, which I thought was just, I mean, I thought that's the story. The Jewish Standard is, you know, the Jewish Standard has a story of caving into pressure to not announce LGBT weddings, Jewish weddings in their paper. Now, obviously, that's a little more of a liberal problem. I mean, you know.
Right.
However, one of the main, JQI went to meet the Jewish Standard, and honestly, one of the main reasons why the Jewish Standard stopped publishing LGBT weddings was because of financial pressure.
Yeah.
They even said it. And my question was, when did it become okay for news organizations and for networks to basically just come across and say, we are cowards?
Right.
Why is that okay?
Right.
It's not. And, you know, to basically say, well, we're just going to, you know, lock away all of our ideals and convictions because of financial pressure, even though we're a news organization, is just really, I would think, embarrassing. And the fact that the Jewish press did not do that.
Held their ground.
Publicly did not do that.
Yeah.
It's huge progress, and I think that it's a testament to the empowering of Orthodox LGBT youth to come out and to tell their stories. And that's, when I tell people all the time about that I work in the Orthodox community and I try to really get these youth to feel comfortable and feel able to tell their stories, they all ask, well, you know, aren't you, you know, by making it more comfortable for them to stay in the Orthodox community, aren't you really doing them a disservice? And because, you know, there's such possibility outside the Orthodox community.
Right.
And my answer to them is, well, one of the most heroic things about Rosa Parks is that she stayed in Alabama.
Right.
It would have been very easy for Rosa Parks just to go up to New York, and she can sit anywhere she wanted on the bus. But it's the idea of staying in the communities that you or your families are, you grew up, and making sure that those communities are as welcoming and as respectful and as safe as possible, that's how the real change happens.
That's how we create change. Well, we do have to talk about your musical selections for this week's episode.
Music.
So we only have time to do two of them. We only have time for two of them, so I randomly chose because I can do that. This is the part of the show where you tell our listening audience what your musical selections say about Zach Mordechai. Are you ready? It's a little self-analysis,
exactly.
Perhaps in the third person, but you know, whatever you're comfortable with. Yeah. What does one of my favorite songs, Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now, what does that say about Zach?
That song spoke to me as a kid.
Yeah.
When I felt completely trapped and completely unable to express myself, did not think I had a future, I knew that all I needed was, you know, one or two friends, one or two people who can see, you know, can say, hey, you know, you and me together, baby, and we can do anything, and no wall is too high, and we can really accomplish anything that we want. I mean, it was such an inspirational song as a kid. I used to blast it from my tape recorder.
That was the song that made me go to different department stores and talk to male mannequins hoping they would come to life.
That is hysterical. I love mannequins.
I'm just saying. That's what that song did for me. But that's not me self-analyzing. This is your turn. It's your time. Let's do one more. One more. Belinda Carlisle's Heaven is a Place on Earth. I mean, come on. One of the best songs out there. What does that say about Zach?
Absolutely. I think these song choices are major. I'm a child of the 80s. But I think that, I mean, that's a little deeper. I think that people sometimes are trying to find, you know, salvation and heaven and spirituality and everything somewhere else. They say, you know, they look at their lives and they say, well, it's not here. It's not, you know, things are too difficult. Things are too confusing. Things are too, and you know, if only life was more simple or easier. And I think that that's not the message. The message is that you can make your own heaven.
There you go.
That we have access to our own happiness. That no matter what's going on in your life, you can choose to be happy, you know, and at least for the moment.
At least for the moment.
And that's this message, that heaven is a place on earth. Heaven is something that we can create together.
Nice.
So they're definitely connected songs, both very inspirational, both hopefully sending a message that you can, everyone has access to celebrate something. And if there's one message that I'd like to be sending, it's that. Go celebrate your life.
Go and you say this as a self-described gay Jewish superhero. And what our listeners
that's actually taken out of context from my.
I don't feel that it is. Our listeners, well, I feel it's totally in context, and I bookended it with all the information that everyone needs to know, which leads to the question of what does a gay Jewish superhero's outfit look like? Is there a cape?
Well, it's reinventing itself.
Okay.
I'll tell you one thing. It doesn't have it's not made. It's no longer made of spandex.
Okay. It's not.
No spandex. But absolutely, there's a cape. That was always the most fabulous part of everybody's all the superheroes outfit. The way the cape just kind of ruffled in the wind, and there are tzitzis attached to that cape. So
wow.
You know, tzitzis, the little fringes.
You're preaching to the choir here.
Yeah, baby. There it is.
That was my mistake there in Temple Emmanuel there in Woodcliff Lake, New Jersey. I never dressed up as a gay Jewish superhero.
You're missing out. You know what? Purim is around the corner.
It is just around the corner. And what is also around the corner is Keshet's Cabaret.
Yes.
So that is on March 17, 2012. I will be there.
Good.
I will be there, so I will see you there. And folks, if you want more information on seeing Zach and seeing Judy Gold and Ari Gold and everybody else who's ever been on this show is so gay, Idit Klein, she's been on the show. Basically, we just troll the audience for guests. Go on over to Keshet Online, K-E-S-H-E-T, online.org. It's right there on their homepage. It's exciting.
Yeah, it's going to be one hell of an evening.
Do you know what you're doing yet?
I wouldn't tell, even if I did.
I'm just checking to see if you know. You don't have to preview it for us.
Of course, I know. It'll be fun and fabulous and outrageous and make people say, huh?
Nice. That's what we're going for. So folks can check that out. And, of course, if they want to learn more about you, what should they do?
If they want to learn more about me, you can actually – I do not have a webpage because I'm one of the few actors. I believe that you can be an actor in entertainment without a webpage.
There you go.
So you can go online and press Zach Mordechai on your Google, and you will see performances, pictures, articles, whatever you want to know about me. You can troll on the internet and find out what you want to hear.
There you
I'm
go.
I'm all over the place.
Courtney Love, appreciation there on the Zach Facebook page.
Yes, you can also you can befriend me on Facebook if you want, and we can have a conversation. Also, go to jqyouth.org,
nice.
jqyouth.org, which is our youth support and advocacy group for LGBT Jews who grow up Orthodox or for right-wing religious.
And can conservative people like me get involved?
Absolutely. We have people from all the denominations. It's really not about being Orthodox. It's about helping people in very, very closed, kind of strict family upbringings who may be at risk. So I think you don't even have to be Jewish to be involved.
There you
go. The idea is that no matter what religion or denomination you are, everybody, even right-wing Christians, right-wing Muslims, right, it doesn't make a difference. Every kid has a right to feel free and happy and supported and safe. So I think that, you know, it has less to do with who you are and more to do with finding these populations that are at risk and helping them.
Entertainment, social justice. He's performing at the cabaret, Zach.
Look at that. I'm just trying to make my mother even prouder that I quit medical school.
I think this will do it. For some reason, I think this episode will make my mother proud, too. So you're helping me as well.
Well, anything I can.
Zach, all the best. We will see you at the cabaret.
Yay. See you soon.
Thanks, Zach.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Looking in your eyes, I see a paradise. This world that I found is too good to be true. Standing here beside you, want so much to give you this love in my heart.
All right, folks, and we are back. Another cool op-ed out there, very insightful, on advocate.com, entitled "Our Groups Need More Color in Their Rainbow," written by our buddy Jimmy Nguyen, the award-winning lawyer, LGBT rights activist, diversity leader, and new media expert. Jimmy, welcome back to The Show Is So Gay.
Thanks very much, Ken. I'm happy to be back.
Let's talk about this piece. So we talked before, you blew the lid off of why people aren't giving money to the LGBT organizations, and my assumption is that all the LGBT fundraising just skyrocketed after that.
I wish I could say that. I don't think that is exactly true.
We don't know, though, so we can assume that it is true.
We don't know. We can hope.
We can hope. What are we pulling the curtain back this time on? Because I read the piece, and you're opening a bit of a can of worms. We're not supposed to be talking about these things, Jimmy.
Well, I'm opening up the can of worms about race relations in the LGBT community, which is always a sensitive topic, but I think one that is critical for our community as itself a minority group to talk about. So the curtain I'm pulling back is simple. The LGBT organizations are nonprofit entities and are civil rights and political action organizations. They need more racial diversity in the organizations, particularly at the top levels of the executive director, other managing directors, and on their boards.
And in one of the most nuanced questions I've ever asked on this show, Jimmy, why?
There are a litany of reasons. One is we are ourselves a minority community.
Yes.
And we should be the role model for diversity inclusion, because we are ourselves a community of people who are not treated fairly. And as a result, I think we need to be much more inclusive in how our community addresses the racial minorities that are part of our group. Secondly, I think from the perspective of winning the LGBT equality rights movement, we can only fully win that movement if we embrace a full spectrum of viewpoints and backgrounds. And so this is important for a number of factors. One is we need support and involvement of the racial minority members of our community. And if our gay organizations are run predominantly by gay white men, it's harder to engage, let alone understand and be sensitive to the unique needs of African American gays and lesbians, Hispanic Americans, or Asian Americans, for example. In addition, we need the support from allied groups, such as the NAACP, the Asian American Pacific Legal Center, our minority ally groups in the more mainstream straight community. They come to our defense, and they stand by us in filing amicus briefs, for example, in civil rights impact litigation for the LGBT community, such as in the Prop 8 case that's been going on out in California. And it's easier to engage with those groups and get their support if our gay organizations have ourselves racial minorities in our leadership. And there was a lot of criticism during the Prop 8 campaign about whether or not the people who fought for our community against Prop 8 adequately engaged minority communities. And I won't get into that debate now, but I think it is a fair statement that as a group, we in the LGBT community can do better at getting participation and involvement and support from all the different colors of our rainbow, not just the gay white men who traditionally have been the ones at the top of LGBT organizations.
And not to separate this out too much from your other op-ed about giving to LGBT organizations, there's certainly an economic current that runs through this issue as well, is there not?
Absolutely. So I have sat on the board of an LGBT organization myself. I was on the board of directors for Equality California for a number of years. And here's what I saw. When you are asked to be on a board of an LGBT organization, it's usually because you have strong relationships to bring to bear that can provide value to the organization, usually in terms of fundraising or providing visibility and services to the entity, or you yourself have money that you can contribute, or you have friends that have money who can contribute to the organization. That's one of the main reasons any entity wants you on their board. So when I sat around having to raise money for their organization, I would go through my electronic Rolodex of contacts, you know, my friends in the LGBT community, thinking, who, you know, could I call upon who would actually have the resources to make a contribution or to buy a table at a major fundraising event or otherwise financially support the organization? And the number of racial minority friends I have, and I have quite a few, being an Asian American, you know, gay person myself, the number of my own friends who are racial minorities who fit that bill was really small, that I felt comfortable who could write a $5,000 check or even a $1,000 check.
Right.
Whereas the number of gay white men I knew who fit that bill was a larger number. And so I think there is some truth to the simple proposition that racial minorities in our country tend to make less money than our white male counterparts, and I think that's true for people who have the same level of educational attainment, irrespective of sexual orientation. And because of that, they are less likely to be invited onto boards or to be invited into positions of leadership at LGBT organizations because for natural fiscal reasons, the organizations want people who can bring the money.
Yeah.
You know, money talks. And as a result, I think historically the organizations have drawn fewer racial minorities into their higher ranks for that reason. And then the second reason is a purely social one. I think our community still is racially segregated, even though in metropolitan cities like Los Angeles, where I live, or New York, there is much more mixing of races in the LGBT community. I think our social circles still are stratified by race.
Right.
And the a-gay social circles who tend to go to the big gay fundraisers, tend to get involved in these big gay organizations, they're still predominantly white.
Right.
And I've stood in many a ballroom at a big gay fundraiser to find myself one of a small number of racial minorities in the room. So that has to do with social circles, and that is reinforced, in my view, by the money component of needing money or access to money or access to people with money in order to be of value to the gay organization.
And this is one of my favorite lines in the piece. You wrote, to the many LGBT nonprofit entities out there, by all means, continue with the diversity initiatives, but please make it more than an agenda item to discuss at your board meetings. I mean, I'm an executive at a nonprofit. That's part of what I do in my day-to-day life outside of this radio show. And it pops up on agendas. How can we be more diverse? How can we be more diverse? But it's not necessarily an initiative that runs through our day-to-day operations, which is where it needs to be.
I absolutely agree. I'm someone who is very involved in diversity in general, not just in the LGBT community, in corporate America as well. I'm tired of diversity as a talking point,
Yeah. You
know, as a discussion item. We sit around in meetings and talk about how we need more diversity. I don't think anyone would seriously dispute that.
Right.
What I get tired of is that no one actually has any concrete ideas or action items an organization can take. And I also get tired of the notion that it's up to the racial minorities in the room,
of course,
to be the ones who everyone looks to help solve the problem,
right?
Then, you know, people will look at me in the room and say, well, don't you know more Asian people we could invite to this event or get onto the board? And the answer is, yeah, I'm sure I do, but it shouldn't be only up to me. And I recognize I probably bear a special extra burden and weight to do that, just like my other racial minority friends and colleagues, but it shouldn't be only up to us. So I would encourage all organizations to make it more than just an agenda item, and that is forcing yourself to decide at the end of every meeting, okay, what is one or maybe two different things we can do between now and our next meeting to advance the ball on diversity?
Or my favorite, hey, Jimmy, tell me what all the gay Asians think about this.
No, I know. That's really funny because it's, you know, there's the joke that all Asians, we all look alike to white people, which may be true for some people. But there's also this perception that we are a monolith, right?
Yes.
That, for example, all Asians, whether gay or not, think the same, are the same. And we're not. We all come from different countries, cultures, languages. I'm Vietnamese, right? Which doesn't mean I automatically know what a Japanese person would be thinking or their cultural background.
What?
Right. Just as if you were, you know, from Mexico, you wouldn't necessarily understand the culture from Spain, from, you know, a Spanish-speaking perspective. So I think there's also that perception that, oh, he's a Gaysian, therefore he must just know what all the Gaysians think.
Right.
Or, more importantly, what you know, there's the sometimes perception that I know what African-American people think or Hispanic-American people think because I should be the speaker for all racial minorities. And I think there's certainly commonalities. Let's not, you know, go too far. There are commonalities in the racial minority experience. But it shouldn't be up to, you know, any one person to voice that experience for all people in the communities of color.
Now, we talked a little bit off the air because all the drama usually goes down in the comments section. I should have gotten my PhD in the comments section, not in the regular articles that I studied to get a doctorate, because I think it's way more fun looking in the comments section. So much more fun.
People can really get scathing sometimes.
Now, you expressed, and tell me if I'm mischaracterizing, a little bit of surprise that there weren't more scathing remarks, scathing comments in response to this piece. I am not at all surprised. I thought that, yes, people are too scared to even write comments on this, except, Jimmy, this is a great piece. Which it is a great piece, it's not to say it's not. But for folks to put themselves out there, oh gosh, I don't want to say anything contrary because I might be labeled a racist. So it doesn't surprise me at all that folks are scared of this topic.
I can see that view.
I don't agree with it.
I don't agree with it. My experience is that anytime you talk about race relations,
right,
whether it be inside or outside the LGBT community, there are some people who get very sensitive about it
and
have very emotional reactions to it. So I expected actually more strong negative comments on the article not because people disagree we need more diversity at the top of our nonprofit organizations,
right,
but I think because of my view that the lack of diversity has to do with our historical social construct.
Yes.
And the notion that, you know, we are a socially segregated community, even though I'm sure people would agree with that, I think, you know, I was expecting a little bit more negative reaction to that. In addition, the last time I wrote a real race based topic for theadvocate.com was about a year ago when I wrote this piece called Gaysians Are Beautiful about what I called racial lookism in the gay male community in particular.
Why the gay rainbow needs to embrace more colors of beauty.
Correct, right. And, you know, I was talking about the fact that I thought gay men were racist in their perception of beauty. They're just sort of lookist, and that affects the social atmosphere in gay male community groups. And I got a lot of negative reaction from that, as well as a lot of positive, affirming reaction. And I don't write pieces just for everyone to agree with me. I pick topics that I think are worthy of discussion.
Yeah.
But from that experience, I saw and was slightly surprised at the time into thinking that I was writing something which I thought was relatively non-controversial. We should all be more open to different visions of beauty in our society.
How dare you?
How dare I, right? But I actually noticed that it triggered a lot of strong emotional reaction from people who were, you know, gotten to hold debates about whether it was racist or not to like only people from certain cultural or racial backgrounds versus another, or whether or not I just had a chip on my shoulder and I needed to like get over it. So I was expecting this time when you write about race and you're basically saying, look, gay community, you're racially segregated.
Yeah.
I think it's still a true statement, and I have been intrigued by the fact that there's been not more negative flack about it.
All right, well, hopefully we will inspire more negative flack. That's what we're here to do as a
race. We should always inspire a lot of discussion, and I think it's critical for all of us in the LGBT community. So everyone listening out there, it's critical that we be able to talk openly about race issues.
Yeah.
Just because we are the gay community, we're not a monolith in and of ourselves. We all have different groups that have different cultural and racial sensitivities and language sensitivities that we need to talk about. If we're going to win the equal rights movement for the gay community, we have to get everybody engaged, and that means everyone from every corner and color of our rainbow.
And it means engaging allies as well, because God knows, this is what I do for a living. I teach the sociology of race to college students and mostly to white college students. And of course it's challenging and, oh gosh, what do I have to say as a gay white Jew? But it's allies who can do such great work in this area too. But if the fear incapacitates us, the conversation won't go anywhere.
Absolutely, and I'll tell you, you as the gay white male Jew, I've got a lot to hear from you, and we should listen to it. But I think part of the lesson we've seen in the gay marriage battles, for example, is that there's something uniquely powerful about African-American groups as the NAACP stepping forward and saying, you know what, this is just like when states tried to ban interracial marriage.
Exactly.
It puts our struggle as the gay community into historical context, that more of our straight allies, straight politicians, and straight voters can understand and actually relate to and maybe feel like, all right, I may not love the LGBT community, but what's being done to them is not fair, just like it wasn't fair to other racial groups. And
there
so there's something really powerful about that. And we need more racial minorities to be talking about this issue in their community. So if you are a gay African-American man, we need you in our organization so that you can take our talking points into your community and take the feedback you receive about what's effective or not back to us so that as the organizational leadership, they can then shape their campaigning and messages and strategy better, because they're not going to know how to talk to your community. You are.
Right. Well, the name of the piece is Our Groups Need More Color in Their Rainbow. You can find it over on advocate.com. You should, of course, stroll on over to JimmyNguyen.com to read all the cool things that this radical Jimmy Nguyen is doing. Are you a radical? You're a bit of a radical.
I'm not a bit of a radical. I'm a change agent, or as one
That's
of my friends
what
once
we
called
like.
Me, an Asian of change.
Oh, look, it's almost like a pun.
Almost like a pun. No, I really just want everybody in our community to learn to speak up and really shine, because that's how we're going to help win all the things we need to do in our struggle for equality.
There you go. Jimmy, when you write the next piece, you're coming back on the show.
Would love to.
All the best, Jimmy.
Bye.
Don't get me wrong, still gonna spend my money.
That is it for us, folks. What a jam-packed show. Thank you to all of this week's guests. Get out there, everybody. Go do whatever it is that you do to use your voice. And while you're doing it, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
You know how to throw a party. We can